The headlines: concerns are growing about the health conditions of 6 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are on hunger strike against their administrative detention. Germany for the first time seeing 50,000 COVID cases in a day, in pace with a sharp surge across Europe. And dozens of people are dead as heavy rains and flooding hit southern India and Sri Lanka. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: there's growing concern about the health conditions of 6 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who've been on hunger strike for months. The inmates are protesting their administrative detention and Israeli policy under which Palestinians are jailed without charge or trial. Human rights and international organizations have time and again drawn attention to the imminent danger facing these 6 inmates because of their poor health. One of them, Ala Araj, is running the risk of losing his eyesight due to weeks of starvation. Another one, Mirdad Al-Rawasmi, has been sent to the prison's healthcare unit after spending some time in an ICU ward. Hundreds of Palestinians are being locked up in horrible conditions in Israeli jails where medical services are absent, even for those with the most severe of illnesses.
Kayed Al-Fasfus, 32, was arrested in October last year and has been on hunger strike for 119 days now. He suffers from severe deterioration of his physical conditions. Mehdad Al-Qawasame, 24, has spent 4 years of his life in Israeli jails and is currently being held at a hospital ICU ward. He's been on hunger strike for more than 100 days. Ala Al-Araj has been transferred to the hospital on several occasions during his administrative detention. The 34-year-old engineer has been refusing to eat for more than 90 days. He has difficulty walking and a weakened vision. Hisham Abu Hawash, 39, is into his 85th day of hunger strike. He's hospitalized with a critical health condition. He suffers from chronic headaches, severe pain, and refuses to take any supplements except for water. Ayad Al-Harimi from Bethlehem, in detention since April, is currently being held in solitary confinement. He's been on hunger strike for 48 days. Lo'ay Al-Ashbar from Tulkarm, 45, has been refusing to eat for more than a month. He has been held captive for 8 years of his life. He became paralyzed in one leg during an investigation.
Germany is joining the list of European countries that are dealing with an uptick in COVID infections and deaths. Just in the past 24 hours, the country has had more than 50,000 new infections, and over 230 people have died of the disease during the same period. Germany's overall death toll has now exceeded 97,000. The overall caseload is close to the grim milestone of 5 million. Experts are warning that if the aggressive fourth wave is not contained, Germany could see 100,000 more fatalities. There are concerns that the surge could overwhelm hospitals and even force the postponement of surgeries. And the European Union foreign policy chief has warned that Europe is in danger amid fears that the continent's military capabilities are not enough to counter threats. Josep Borrell says threats against Europe are intensifying and the capacity of individual member states to cope with them is insufficient and declining. Borrell believes EU countries need to have rapid deployment capabilities. According to the top EU diplomat, one idea is to have a 5,000-strong crisis force to be able to deal with those threats. Borrell's comments come ahead of a summit of EU foreign and defense ministers to discuss the issue. We've asked former lecturer at Westchester University, Lawrence Davidson, to give us his analysis of Borrell's call for ramped-up defense power. He believes that Europe is actually seeking to reduce its dependence on the U.S. for military support.
I think you can see it as another crack in the hegemonic reliance on the United States. The United States, it did intervene in the Balkans, for instance, But it's hard to see, you know, the United States and EU countries directly. I think you're probably right. I mean, this is just, in part anyway, an effort to increase self-reliance and a recognition that whether Biden gives his okay to this, I assume he has, or not, they can't rely on the United States in terms of future administrations, because one of the things that Trump proved is that there's a question mark as to the reliability of the American citizen to recognize any reliable affiliation with Europe.
Tensions are escalating between Belarus and the European Union. Minsk now says it will certainly reciprocate if the bloc moves to sanction it over the migrant crisis on the country's joint border with Poland.
We're heeding Europe. They are still threatening us that they will close the border. And if we shut off natural gas there, therefore, I would recommend that the Polish leadership, Lithuanians, and other heedless people think before speaking.
Lukashenko claims migrants have been receiving weapons, suggesting that there could be a possible provocation at the border. The EU is threatening to hit Belarus with fresh sanctions over the crisis next week. But Belarus is accusing the EU of trying to shift the blame on the country to justify its new sanctions. Thousands of asylum seekers remain stuck near the Belarusian border with Poland in freezing weather. Guards and police forces are deployed on the Polish side to block the migrants from getting in. China's warning against the renewal of Cold War divisions and confrontations in Asia-Pacific amid continued regional tensions over the issue of Taiwan. The fresh warning from President Xi Jinping comes just days before his planned virtual meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden. Taipei has been a major sticking point between the two sides. Early U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated Washington's military support for Taiwan right after a U.S. delegation's visit to the island angered China. Beijing says Washington should stop all forms of official interaction with Taipei. The Chinese embassy in the U.S. has urged Washington to cooperate to bring the two countries' relations back on track, saying both sides gain from cooperation and lose from confrontation. International and independent China strategist Andrew Loynes tells us that the United States is seeking to maintain its dominance around the world, and that's the reason why its military provocations in Southeast Asia.
In fact, it is a part of a struggle to maintain the so-called American dominance in the world, in a so-called American-led liberal order. So there's still a body of thought in the United States clinging to the fading concept of American hegemony or American unipolarity, where American could just call the shots. Obviously, the capacity of the United States to maintain this kind of dominance is much more emaciated in recent years. But still, a lot of the people in the United States, not only in the military, but in the elite, and even a lot of American people, especially those who are less educated, even including those who are educated, refuse to accept a rising power that could almost equal America in terms of global influence.
Sri Lanka and parts of India are reeling under heavy rains. More than 40 people are dead in both countries. Most of the victims in Sri Lanka were drowned. Landslides have also injured a number of people there. And in a neighboring southern Indian state, officials are evacuating thousands of people from low-lying areas. Thousands of houses are destroyed and roads remain deluged. India's monsoon season usually runs from October to December, bringing heavy rain particularly to the south. Weather forecasters are expecting the downpours to ease in the coming days. New Delhi has sent thousands of additional forces to Indian-administered Kashmir after the deadly October violence in the region that killed nearly 40 people. The growing surveillance of Kashmir residents in and around Srinagar has also sparked fear and panic among the people in the city. Our correspondent, Sean Abbott, reports.
Scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints, and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Deployment. Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
Authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full. After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahan Abbott, Indian-administered Kashmir.
No end in sight to Saudi Arabia's military aggression against neighboring Yemen. Yemeni media say Saudi warplanes attacked locations across Sana'a, Saada, and Amran provinces hours ago. No casualties have been reported from those attacks, but in a separate incident, a Yemeni civilian lost his life when Saudi forces opened fire across the border in Saada province. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. Since then, hundreds of thousands have lost their lives and many more have been displaced. The years-long aggression has also targeted the country's infrastructure, leaving the Yemeni people in abject misery. The United Nations has called the situation in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, says the Saudi warplanes targeted civilian and residential areas in the latest round of airstrikes earlier today. Let's take a listen.
The Saudi airplanes were hovering yesterday over Sana'a and Saada and other governorates. They hit several targets near to civilian and residential areas. These airstrikes came after the Yemeni army announced that its missile force have successfully hit the regiment camp in Asir with three ballistic missiles. So the Saudi coalition is escalating its attacks in civilian and residential areas, and this is a clear violation of the international law that the Saudi or the kingdom has been violating during 7 years of war and the blockade against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community is doing nothing to help the Yemeni people, so they depend and they say that they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces to keep pressuring Saudi Arabia, to keep forcing Saudi Arabia not only to flee or to expel these powers to get out of the country, but also to stop their war and to force them to lift the siege.
Iran has become a full member of the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession to the top scientific body came despite stiff opposition from the Israeli regime and the U.S. We have a report on that.
Another moment of pride for Iran at the United Nations for its active partnership since joining the world body in 1950. The country has now become a full member of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession was approved by a unanimous vote at the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. UNSCEAR rarely expanded to include new members, but under the resolution proposed by Australia, four countries were admitted, raising the number to 31. Norway, Algeria, and the UAE were other nations who joined the body. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, praised the General Assembly's decision to admit Iran into the committee. He expressed Tehran's full support for the body in its scientific endeavors to protect the planet and humans.
Iran reiterates its full support for and cooperation with the UNSCEAR in order to further enhance the infrastructure capacity and training of its personnel, as well as support nuclear safety, protect the public health and the environment from the harmful effects of atomic radiation.
Iran's accession is perceived as a major step forward since the top UN scientific body on nuclear safety has always been under Western influence. As expected, the decision faced stiff opposition from Israel and the US. Takht Ravanchi responded to anti-Iran allegations raised by Israel and the U.S. He said the track record of Tel Aviv and Washington show they are not in a position to oppose Iran's membership to the scientific committee. The Iranian envoy said that while the Israeli regime has flagrantly violated many UN resolutions and defied international efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction, Washington dishonored its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. A nuclear scientist has hailed Iran's accession to the committee as a very positive step.
In general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end it will be a very positive step for Iran.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
I wish to raise a few points about foreign policy as well. Of course, there are many issues that need to be raised about foreign policy, which will be discussed in the right time and place. Briefly, foreign policy is very important, and it greatly influences the affairs of the country. We should be more active in the area of diplomacy. In diplomacy, the economic aspect should be strengthened, because economic diplomacy is a very important matter. Today, one can see that although many countries have a foreign minister, presidents themselves discuss economic matters with other countries or with a specific country. In other words, economic relations with other countries are very important. Therefore, the economic aspect of diplomacy should be strengthened. And foreign trade is very important, especially with our neighbors.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We have about 14-15 neighbors, comprised of large populations and offering a big market. But we should not confine ourselves to these countries. And we should establish such relations with other countries as well. There are about 200 plus countries in the world. We do not intend to establish relations with only a few countries, one or two countries. We might not be able to establish relations with some countries, but the possibility exists to establish good and constructive relations with most countries. Diligence is necessary to that end. Another point is that diplomacy should not be overshadowed by the nuclear matter. It should not be the case that the diplomacy of the country is dependent on the nuclear matter. The nuclear matter is a separate matter that should be resolved in a proper manner. But diplomacy is much wider in scope.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States Federal Bureau of Investigation is taken to court over a lawsuit by three Muslim men that alleges the agency illegally conducted surveillance on them on the basis of their religion. Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, Ali Malik, and Yasser Abdul Rahim, the three plaintiffs in the case, argue that the U.S. government has for years invoked national security to escape accountability over its unconstitutional surveillance operations and deny them the chance to present their evidence to the court. Initially filed in 2011, their case was first dismissed by a lower court in favor of the FBI's assertion that allowing it to move forward would pose a national security risk. The trio appealed the ruling, and a federal appeals court later sided with them, paving the way for the case to land in the High Court. The FBI recruited a paid informant to spy on the mosque and other places of worship in the area beginning in 2006. The informant, identified as Craig Monte, had presented himself as a person who wanted to convert to Islam.
They've always tried to label Muslims as potential terrorists and investigate them, monitor them, looking in, you know, all their most of their privacy has been breached. All these mosques, as we can read and study about, is pretty much, you know, it's open to the FBI to, you know, send in informants, spies, make them feel very uncomfortable, and also a lot of them are saying that they feel like second-class citizens or third-class citizens inside their own country.
Pazaga, the lead plaintiff in the case who was also a therapist, said he was furious when he found out that the FBI informant secretly recorded the personal and confidential sessions he had with his patients for a month. The surveillance operation in Southern California was part of a broader spying program that the U.S. government enforced after 9/11, using various tactics to monitor Muslim communities in the name of national security.
This is a systematic problem in the U.S., and they want it to be this way. It's been programmed like this by the U.S. It's because they want to install fear in American citizens everywhere, so they can also justify invasions to Muslim countries and to, invade different Muslim countries.
The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling on the Muslims case by the end of June. Lawyers for the government will argue that the case should be dismissed, as letting it proceed would expose clandestine intelligence operations and harm national security. The FBI has long contended that the information about its informants, methods of surveillance, and who they are monitoring and why should be treated as state secrets. Human rights activists, however, say citing national security concerns is an excuse to avoid admitting that they target people based on their religion. The plaintiffs argue that under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, a judge can review the material and order that it be disclosed. They contend that in a case like theirs, the 1978 law supersedes the state secrets privilege, which was adopted by the Supreme Court in the 1950s. Government lawyers' counter-argument is that FISA was not meant for a case where the government certifies that the disclosure would jeopardize national security. All eyes are on the Supreme Court justices, whose ruling will indicate whether they are willing to protect religious freedoms or if the government has the authority to cover up its illegal activities in the name of national security.
The Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian senior officials and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. Yet, the West, which claims to be against terrorism, supports this terrorist group officially. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US removed the widely detested terrorist group from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012, respectively. West even misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people. On November 4th, the ringleader of MKO, Mayem Rajavi, delivered an online address to an Italian Senate panel on the situation of human rights in Iran. 2 days later, the Secretary of Human Rights Headquarters of the Iranian Judiciary, Kazem Gharibabadi, condemned the session. He slammed Western countries for adopting a selective approach to human rights by allowing the anti-Iran Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization to hold, quote, ridiculous meetings on the issue in the host countries. He also called on the Italian government to end their dual and destructive policies towards terrorism and human rights. Iran, has long complained that the West's backing for terrorist organizations like MKO violates the UN Charter and international principles. The West accuses Iran of human rights violations, yet their double standard policies towards terrorism speak for themselves. Also, in July at a sideline meeting at the 47th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council, diplomats, scholars, and representatives from NGOs criticized Western countries for their hypocrisy on human rights and using it as a geopolitical tool to attack countries that do not serve their interests.
But, you know, groups like MKO have been legitimized as not a terrorist group any longer because it serves a purpose. It's giving Western nations a sort of what they want, creating acts of terrorism in Iran, and indeed assassination of scientists.
The U.S. itself has been long accused of violating human rights. Their violations have been blatant when it comes to racial discrimination, especially against the African American community. The case of George Floyd, an African American man who was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is one example of many. Hezbollah in Lebanon, popular mobilization forces in Iraq, and Ansarullah movement in Yemen are against the interests and policies of the West. Therefore, they are designated as terrorist organizations by Western countries. That's why these streams have fought hard and are the true defenders of the rights of their countries and regional nations. Meanwhile, MKO terrorists enjoy the freedom of activity in the US and Europe, and even hold regular meetings in which European and American officials make speeches. West's support for such a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. And let's not forget the Western countries, namely the US, support for one of the biggest violators of human rights, the Israeli regime, an illegitimate regime that has a long list of human rights violations, including the occupation of Palestinian land, illegal settlement activities, inhumane blockade on Palestinians, administrative detentions, and many others.
There needs to be a unity on combating those who commit acts of terrorism internationally, rather than this sort of use of the terrorist group as allies, and then giving them international support and international legitimacy. MKO is the perfect example of this, but unfortunately is not the only one.
The US, Britain, and France are among violators of human rights. They use sanctions to pressure other governments to give in to their demands, while that directly affects the civilian population and causes hardship for them. These countries have not only supported dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, whom they have sold weapons to in a war on Yemen, they have also supported the Israeli regime that violates Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, the West's anti-Iran obsession and shameful support for terrorism smacks of double standards. The Saudi-led coalition seized three fuel tankers heading for war-torn Yemen nearly 3 months ago. On Saturday, Yemen's petroleum company put out a statement slamming the Saudi-led coalition's illegal confiscation of three oil ships carrying a collective amount of over 80,000 tons of diesel and preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah. Saudi Arabia still prevents vessels from docking in Hodeidah port despite them having received UN permits for sailing in international waters. Earlier this year, Yemen's Minister of Oil and Minerals, Ahmed Abdullah Dares, warned that the Saudi seizure of ships carrying petroleum products could lead to the suspension of the service sectors and cause a humanitarian catastrophe. The fuel blockade contributes to a much broader Saudi-led blockade campaign against Yemenis. The coalition's military forces have stopped planes from landing and ships from docking in Yemen. many critics had prophesied that the blockade would keep much-needed food, fuel, medicine, and humanitarian aid from reaching desperate Yemenis, including millions of children. In fact, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. Also, over 16 million Yemenis are on the brink of acute starvation. That's almost half of the country's population. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies, backed by the US, launched a war on Yemen. Their goal was to reinstate the friendly government of Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi and to eliminate the Ansarullah movement. However, so far they've failed, and the war has only left tens of thousands of people dead and millions more displaced.
There's been a history of the United Nations failing in the region, and as far away as 2016, the UK blocked a call for the establishment of an independent international inquiry. So we can see the United Nations is really controlled by members who have really no interest in the human rights of the people of Yemen.
The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, describing the country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing fuel blockade against Yemen has led to food and medicine shortages. These items cannot be transported without fuel. Also, many hospitals experience power outages as they do not have enough power to keep the lights on amid the coronavirus pandemic. The administration of US President Joe Biden refuses to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen and stopping its deadly airstrikes. On the other hand, it tries to change the narrative in favor of the kingdom. For instance, Washington refuses to blame Riyadh for the current fuel shortage in Yemen. The US says the Saudi coalition only blocks ships and planes that the Hadi government doesn't grant permission to. Therefore, it's the Hadi government that's imposing the blockade. But Washington's shameless support for Saudi Arabia doesn't end here. The Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale follows the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The sale flatly contradicts Biden's sayings during the first major foreign policy speech of his presidency that the U.S. is ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen.
Well, some people believe that America's economy is built around merchandising death in general. The sale of $650 million recently, this week, to Saudi Arabia by the U.S. is really, from their position, the support of the U.S. foreign policy to the national security interests of the United States.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia, saying it proves Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering and that the Biden administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. The arms supplies to Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. But it seems the green Saudi dollars are worth a lot more to the U.S. than the lives of innocent Yemeni civilians and children.
Tensions are simmering in Ethiopia, where a year-long war between government forces and fighters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is feared to intensify. The TPLF is the party ruling in the northern Tigray region. It used to hold power in Ethiopia until the parliamentary elections in 2018, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took over with the support of country's largest ethnic groups, the Oromo and Amhara. On Friday, however, 8 rebel groups, including the Omoro Liberation Front, agreed in Washington to join forces with the TPLF to form a coalition against the government, striking up an alliance between the historic foes.
The main reason why this alliance is significant is it's another example of them using this level of psychological warfare. This particular announcement, and what I would like to say, grandiose event in D.C., coupled with the media's focus of the armies marching to the Capitol in the last few days, is just another way to create this level of manufactured consent from the people so they can feel as though, wow, well, the Ethiopian government is already lost, so I must try to put my hope into TPLF or this alliance in some case.
Ethiopia declared a nationwide state of emergency on the 2nd of November amid concerns that the forces, which are now within a day's drive from the capital Addis Ababa, may be considering attacking the city. The United Nations Security Council called for a halt to the fighting in Ethiopia on Friday, urging talks to end intensifying hostilities.
They further call to put an end to hostilities and to negotiate a lasting ceasefire and for the creation of conditions for the start of an inclusive Ethiopian national dialogue to resolve the crisis and create the foundation for peace and stability throughout the country.
The council members also expressed deep concern about the growing violence in northern Ethiopia. They urged the warring sides to refrain from inflammatory hate speech and incitement to violence. The council members also called for unhindered access for humanitarian aid and the reestablishment of public services, among others. The announcement of the alliance between 9 Ethiopian rebel groups in Washington coincided with the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman's meeting with the Ethiopian Prime Minister amid calls for an immediate ceasefire and talks to end the war.
It's really interesting to note that TPLF has had a long-standing relationship to the U.S. and other European powers. I mean, the evidence here is, look at the ruling party within TPLF or the different officials and generals, and look at their assets and where they're stored.
The United Nations published a report this week that suggests both sides of the conflict have committed atrocities that may amount to war crimes. The conflict in the Tigray region erupted on November 4th last year when Ethiopia launched an offensive against the TPLF troops who allegedly attacked a federal army camp. The government declared victory at the end of November, but clashes have continued in the region. Soon after the start of the conflict, Eritrea, TPLF's longtime enemy, joined Ethiopia in attacking the rebels. The UN report suggests that Eritrean troops have also killed hundreds of civilians in Tigray in a matter of days. Due to a communications blackout and restricted access to the region for journalists, little is known about the extent of humanitarian crisis in the region. The fate of millions of Ethiopians is now hanging in the balance with no end in sight for their persecution in the absence of any meaningful international action.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws, Welcome to the program, Sheikh Jawi.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about the unlawful gains according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Sheikh Javid, in the last episode, I started, in fact, asking you about some of the scenarios, and you kindly provided answers from Ayatollah Khamenei to each one of these scenarios. And let me continue these scenarios in the following way, or step by step. You know, the person works as a paid worker in a place where the mixed foods, I mean, by mixed, like halal mixed with haram foods or food items are being sold.
Yeah.
Irrespective of whether the owner is Muslim or non-Muslim. So what is the Islamic ruling on this?
Well, according to Islamic law, it's haram to involve in the delivering or offering or serving or even selling intoxicants, alcoholic drinks, and of course haram food stuff, anything. I think we discussed this in one of the previous episodes. Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion is very much strict when it comes to dealing with such haram stuff. So working in places where these items of food and drink are sold, of course, is not permissible.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you are not, you know, if you are not going to sell, you know, it's not permissible to work in that place where haram things are sold. For example, if you want to work in a nightclub, or if you want to work as someone who just vacuums the nightclub, or just cleans the nightclub, or does something. Now, of course, Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that it's absolutely forbidden to engage in such things, let alone selling and buying such stuffs like, for example, as we said, pork and meat of haram animal, or meat of halal animal slaughtered, which is not slaughtered according to Islamic law, or buying and selling these things. And of course, and Ayatollah Khamenei says that even taking instructions from others with regard to dealing in such things is not permissible. Whether it does not make any difference whether that person is a paid worker, or he is an owner, or let's say he is a partner, still it's not permissible for that person to engage in such activities. And of course, generally speaking, it's according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's obligatory, it is necessary upon every Muslim to categorically avoid the manufacture, the purchase, or sale of haram foodstuff intended for human consumption. And that's the main point, because human consumption is a very important point that has to be taken into consideration when it comes to selling, to buying, and to dealing with haram stuff like pork, meat of non-halal animals, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
As for, let's say, if there is any rational purposes, like, for example, using such things in medicine, or using these things, giving such things to birds, to animals, of course, there's no problem to sell these things for those purposes, even if one knows that. And if one is not sure, then of course he should exercise precaution. He should not engage in dealing such, in buying and selling these things.
Mm-hmm. How about this scenario? The person either works for or is a partner in the business where unlawful food items and alcoholic drinks are being sold, yet he's not involved directly in the purchase or sale of these foods, and they do not belong to him.
Well,
all right. Yeah. So, however, he has a hand in preparing and selling food items. What is the ruling on the activity of such a person? Mind you that the sold alcoholic drinks are not consumed in the premises.
It does not make any difference whether the, let's say, alcoholic drinks are consumed or not consumed in the same premises, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, of course, Ayatollah Khamenei forbids forbids Muslims from selling, from buying, from getting involved in preparation.
Yes.
Even if he's not an owner, even if he is a paid worker, yet still it's not permissible for such an individual to engage in buying and selling, and also offering and of course getting instructions from other persons. Even if he's owner or if he's a partner, of course, it does not make any difference.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a break, and we'll be back continuing these items or scenarios according to Ayatollah Khamenei. لا إله إلا الله
والله أكبر. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Al-Ali al-Azim. back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are still talking about some of the scenarios with Sheikh Javid, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, on Islamic or Islamically on lawful gains. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to earn income through repairing trucks that carry alcoholic beverages?
Well, if the trucks will be used to carry alcoholic beverages, and one knows that it's a truck used for exclusively for, let's say, for carrying, for transporting alcoholic beverages, it's not permissible to get involved in repairing such trucks. And this is a clear answer from His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He says, obviously, it's not allowed, it's not permissible to get involved in repairing such trucks, you know. But of course, if trucks are used for both halal and haram purposes, there's no objection to someone repairing the truck, because who knows, maybe the truck may be used for more often for halal purposes. Okay, in that case, even according to Ayatollah Sistani, there's no objection to repairing and to repairing that truck or that lorry.
I see. Another question would be about having or finding a job in a company with a network of branches selling goods to the public. Some of these items are haram, such as imported non-halal meat, you know?
Sure.
This necessarily means that part of the company's income is illicit according to the Islamic laws, okay?
Yeah.
Is it permissible to buy goods in such a stores or in the stores of such a company where both halal and haram products are sold?
Well, obviously there's no doubt about it that it is permissible to buy halal stuff, halal things, or halal goods from such stores, because let's say you as a someone who lives in the West, you know, there's no way you can just avoid doing this.
Yes.
Because wherever you go, you find stores selling both alcoholic beverages and halal stuff. So let's say they sell biscuits, and at the same time they sell
pork.
Yes. You know,
in the supermarket.
So general knowledge of the existence of illicit assets among the company should not cast a doubt on the validity of shopping in that company. Of course, Ayatollah Khamenei is Ayatollah Khamenei's answer on his website. He says that unless the company's asset could be dealt with by the mukallaf, of course, he further says that there is no problem for all people to buy their necessary items or things or essentials from such a store. And the answer goes on, the case is also such if one does not know for sure that the very purchased item involves haram things, of course, it is still permissible for that individual. So I said, this is my explanation to this answer, if you live in the West and you are supposed to buy things from the local store, okay? If you do not buy things, you cannot find such a shop or a store,
yes,
or a mall or something where you can buy exclusively halal things. Halal things,
yes,
of course. And at the end of the day, you will get end up facing a lot of problem, and you will go through unbearable pain and suffering, of course. So, and that's not, the Islamic Sharia does not want you to go to that extent of pain and suffering.
Yes.
So that's why.
And sometimes it is very good, in fact, in some of those places, even within the non-Muslim Western countries, that there are some Muslim community living to open up some shop or some stores and companies where all of the Islamically lawful and halal food items are, in fact, distributed.
Sure. There could be some such stores or shops, and of course it's very much recommended to buy your things from such stores, because you are to some degree
yes,
certain that the things that you buy do not contain haram things.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.